Every summer, thousands of passionate readers and writers gather at the Sun Valley Writers Conference in the shared belief that the power of literature begins on the page, but doesn't end there. I'm John Burnham Schwartz, the conference literary director, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our podcast, Beyond the Page. In this episode, we'll be hearing from the Israeli novelist David Grossman, widely regarded as part of the collective liberal conscience of Israel. David Grossman is our poet of exile and also our poet of home. We hold both places within us always, of course. We have no choice. But we are consoled by having the map of this great writer's words to guide us on our journeys. Here is Grossman on the political and literary context of his masterpiece, To the End of the Land.
Shalom. Thank you. Being in our situation in Israel, having the feeling that every time you go out of yourself and you touch the world out of you, it is painful. You face something that is either dangerous or painful or even humiliating. And since the language is part of our senses to touch this reality, one almost instinctively tries to limit the surface of his being that comes in contact with this reality. We see it in our newspapers, we see it in our literature. I'm afraid we see it also in the dialogues that people have among themselves. There is a narrowing down of the public debate, of political opinion makers, the way they converse with each other. After so many years of repeating the same things again and again, the same arguments, we do not really have a dialogue in Israel. And I think that ideology, in a way, is the dialogue that the state has with itself, or a country or a nation has with itself. And we are deprived of ideology. I know I might sound very old-fashioned, but to live in the place where we are living in Israel, we need some ideology. We need a way to be in contact not only with the concrete reality, the concrete facts of our life, but with something that will give us a sense of goal, a sense of hope, if you want. We do not have it anymore. And in a way, I think of us as a suit of armor, but without the knight, the person within this suit of armor. I think that in all my writings, especially in the last book, in To the End of the Land, but in all my writing, and even more so in the act of writing, this is what I try to do, to address the man in the suit of armor and to allow him, of course, first to be a human being in this suit of armor, but even more so to go out of the suit of armor, to remind myself at first and the people who read me that we are not doomed to live in this reality. There is no divine decree that orders us to kill and to be killed and to be trapped forever in such predicament of war and brutality.
Grossman began writing To the End of the Land at a time when both his sons were serving in the Israeli Defense Forces in the occupied territories. He was almost finished with a draft of the novel when his younger son, Ari, was tragically killed in the final days of the Second Lebanon War. Grossman has said that writing gives him back the person I used to be before myself became nationalized and confiscated by the conflict, by governments and armies, by despair and tragedy.
From the very beginning of the writing, it was clear to me that I'm writing about two layers of reality. One is the layer of a family, and the other one is the layer of our situation in Israel. You know that we have a word, a term for this situation. We call it hamatzav. It's a translation of the situation, but it's a kind of a euphemism for a constant bleeding of more than a century. When we say hamatzav, we mean wars and terror and occupation and settlements and hopelessness and all that we condense into one word. And I wanted to be able to decode this term, you know, hamatzav, and to unfold it. And I didn't find a good way of doing that. For years, I think for a decade, I wrote novels about very personal, very intimate topics, like jealousy, or like homeless children in Jerusalem, or like Samson, the biblical hero, because I felt I cannot find the right words that will not turn into cliché. So much of the way in which we describe our situation turned into a cliché, and we ourselves, we become like a cliché in this situation, you know, the cliché of the leftist, the cliché of the rightist, of the settler, of the bleeding heart, all that, we all congealed into clichés. And I felt that unless I find a way to articulate it in a new way, I cannot write about this situation. And then I had this idea about the mother. Ora is her name. Ora in Hebrew means light. And she's a 50 years old woman, very Israeli, very typical Israeli woman, very straightforward and direct and passionate, sometimes tactless even, very intuitive. And she has two sons. She lives separately from her husband, and she has two sons. One of them finished his military service 3 years ago, and one of them, Ofer, is about to end his service after 3 hard years of serving in the occupied territories. And she plans to go on a hike with him to the Galilee, to the north of Israel. And he agrees, but half-heartedly. I think he's a little embarrassed of being together with his mommy alone in nature. But he agrees. And she prepares 2 backpacks, and she buys all the products and everything they will need in their way. But then on the very day that he is supposed to be released from his military service, the day that they are supposed to go out for the hike, Israel starts another military operation in the occupied territories. It is, the dates of it are, of this military operation are a little blurred in the book, but somewhere in 2000 or 2001 or 2002. And Ofer, the boy, the young man, volunteers to serve with his friends in this military operation. And she's outraged, and she tells him, how can you do that? After 3 years, you can be free, you can be out. And he says, yes, but for 3 years I was prepared for this military operation. And on top of that, I want to be with my friends. I am loyal to my friends. Which, by the way, I think this is maybe the major motivation of young people to fight. Not because of idealism, not because of patriotism, but because of a kind of comradeship to their friends. And he goes to the army. He doesn't join her. He asks her to drive him to the gathering point of the army. And she does that. She brings him there. She leaves him there. She goes back home. She's paralyzed. She has a very strong intuition that very soon the notifiers from the army will come with the terrible news about him. You have to know, and maybe you know, that in Israel, there is a very developed machinery of the army to notify you if your son was dead in the army. And they come and they knock at your door at any hour of the day or the night, and they will throw this notification into your face. This is how they do it. And suddenly it occurs to Ora that it takes 2 for bad news. One to deliver and one to receive. And what if she's not there to receive? Maybe all this machinery, this wheel of machinery of the notification will be taken aback for a day until they'll find her, or an hour, even a minute will do at such circumstances. And she runs away from home. She takes the 2 backpacks with her. She goes to the very end of Israel, to the north, to the Galilee, and on her way, she almost kidnaps a man who is not her husband. His name is Avram. And Avram was the love of her youth and maybe the love of her life. And Avram, when he was young, he was like a sparkle of light and passion and imagination and sensuality and creativity. And then in the 73 war, the Yom Kippur war, he fell captive at the Egyptians' captivity. And he returned destroyed mentally, physically. He doesn't want to live. He doesn't want to have any contact with life. He keeps alive. He survives. But he's not living life with all the dimensions that life can suggest. And she kidnaps Avram with her. She takes him with her because she feels she needs to tell him about Ophir, about her child, that gradually we understand that Avram was very much connected to this Ophir, but he didn't want to know anything about him, because to be connected to someone, to be sympathetic to someone, means to be very vulnerable. It means that, in a way, you are a hostage of your love towards this someone. And Avram cannot take anymore. His software is full already. He doesn't want too much. But she needs to tell. She feels that by telling the story life of Ophir, she can protect him. Again, it's a very stupid, magical thought, but what can she do otherwise? She cannot come and kidnap Ophir from the army. He doesn't want to be kidnapped. He wants to be there. So she does the only thing that a mother can do, and this is really to tell all the minutiae of life of Ophir to Avram, to the reluctant Avram, to tell him about all the most primal, intimate moments of raising up a child. I think we all know that, even if we do not have children, we witnessed it, we saw it. From the moment when she breastfed him, and she describes all these intimate, loving moments where she looks at his eyes and he looks at her, and she feels that at that very moment she is imprinted in the pupil of his eyes, and she knows, she experiences a moment of eternity with that intimacy. And she also knows that never in her life she will be as beautiful as she is now in his eyes.
Grossman has said that when he writes, he tries to bring himself to this point. To be betrayed, to be taken to a dangerous place that jars the basic presumptions he has about himself, his family, and his country.
The moment when Ophir, the son, comes back from the army for a leave of 1 week after being out in the field in the occupied territories for more than a month, and he comes back home and he looks at home and he cannot believe his eyes. You know, he cannot connect the reality he comes from, the reality of occupation, of terror, of roadblocks, to the softness and the tenderness and the exposedness of home. It's too delicate. It's criminally exposed. He cannot believe that such reality exists. In a way, he does not connect the exteriority of the state where he is stationed with the interiority that he's supposed to defend, as if there is no contact between them two. He looks at his parents, and they seem to him too soft, unable to defend themselves in this harsh, unbearably violent life. And in a way, I think it is a metaphor, if you want, to all our being, to the way the exteriority, the violent infiltrates into our internal organs. In the way we, all of us, do not really believe in in what I've and my wife, we have experienced in this place, for example, you know, that you can have opponents, but you do not have real enemies, existential enemies. And I, you know, when I walk in such a place like here, like Sand Valley, you know, I feel the way I walk is different. The way, you know, I breathe with both lungs suddenly. And I hope you are able to understand it, because you were, most of you were born here. You really do not have any existential threat. You have problems here. You have debates between Democrats and Republicans, and we know all about that. But your life is not at stake as it is for us. And that changes everything. You know, the knowledge that your future is not really guaranteed. Israel has a very glorious past, Israel and the Jewish people, and very active and agitative present, but future is always a very dubious word. And this is something, this is the major subcurrent of the book, of To the End of the Land, even the name of the book. And at first I didn't like this title, and then I thought, yes, it says something deep about us, you know, to the end of the land. This is a permanent fear for us. Because if you read in an American paper that America plans a major national project for the year 2031, it sounds perfectly normal and natural, yes? If an Israeli person reads this, Israel in the year 2031, you know, when I think of it, I feel immediately a kind of a pang in my heart, as if I violated a taboo by allowing myself too much quantities of future.
For almost four decades, David Grossman has been giving us stories so original and vivid in the details of private life, so emotionally honest in the face of unthinkable loss, that cumulatively they represent, to paraphrase the title of one of his earlier novels, an intimate grammar of existence, not only in the land of Israel, but indeed everywhere.
You know, Israel is our homeland. It's meant to be like that. I wish it to be like that. I don't want to live in any other place on earth. I keep getting all kind of proposals to go and to be here or to teach there. I don't want it. Maybe it's because I'm a little provincial in my character, and maybe it's because it's so interesting for me to be in this place with all the difficulties. But Israel is the only place on earth that I'm not a foreigner. That even when it freaks me out, I can decode the codes of the behavior of people, and I understand them deeply. And it's the only place where things are really relevant for me. Yes, I told you that this place is like a dream, but it's not my dream. And Israel, even when it's my nightmare, it has the potential to become my very realistic, down-to-earth dream. And yet, it is not the home that it can be. It is not a home because, you know, in the last 64 years of our independence, our borders move constantly. We do not have fixed borders. Can you imagine? Every decade, our borders shift and they withdraw and they expand. It's like to live in a home that the walls are mobile all the time. You never know where you end, where the other starts, where the enemy starts. It creates all kinds of ambiguities, a temptation to invade you. You have the temptation to conquer them. We need borders. We need solid borders between us and our neighbors. This is the first remedy to the situation. I'm not talking about a wall between us. A wall is wrong. It eternalizes stereotypes and prejudices. We need normal borders with gates to allow people and trades and ideas to commute. This will be the beginning of the recovery. I think that we must insist on imagining peace as a way to defy this reality of despair and of paralysis. It's a voluntary act even subversive act sometimes to imagine peace when the situation is so despairing. Now, I'm not doing it, I hope, in a foolish Hollywoodian way. You know, I do not think of us and the Palestinians walk hand in hand to the sunset, not at all. I know the way both peoples have been distorted by such almost eternal violence and hatred to each other. I do not believe in solutions of binational states, because I think these two peoples cannot coexist in one state. They are so contradictory to each other. But I insist on imagining a situation in which these two peoples will be able first to look at reality also from the point of view of the other side, to understand the tragedy of the other side, to understand the story that the other side tells himself, to look at ourselves also from the point of view of them. You know, sometimes it is your enemy who sees in yourself the things that you prefer not to know, the things that you tell yourself, oh, they are only temporary. After war is over, I will be able to regain all my humanistic moral qualities. It doesn't work like that. And sometimes looking at myself through the eyes of my enemy reveals to me things that are horrifying. I, by the way, always believe that the most important, the most meaningful moments in the history of mankind, they have not occurred on battlefields and not in palaces or in parliaments, but rather in kitchens and in bedrooms and also in rooms of children. And I am looking for these places. I want to understand the effect and the infect of those big historic events on the life of individuals, what it does to them, how it changes them, how it changes their intimacy, how it takes over their language, over the way they are raising up their children, on their very intimate concepts of time, of belonging, of love, of giving themselves away to an idea or to other human being. All these are so much more meaningful than telling about, you know, the big war. Shalom. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Page, the Sun Valley Writers Conference podcast. To hear David's unedited talk, to explore the free archive of Sun Valley Writers Conference recordings, and to learn more about the conference, please visit svwc.com. I'm John Burnham Schwartz, and thanks for listening.
Beyond the Page is produced by John Burnham Schwartz and James Tooley. Original music by Dean Grinsfelder, and production support provided by Jay Shilliday, Michael Neese, and the Network Studios.